Okay, good evening and welcome. And thanks for giving up your, well, partially giving up your evening to come to this event. It's going to be fairly lightning speed because there's an awful lot of information I want to give you, and I want to give you a really good solid overview. I'm not going to do the marketing hype, all right? So I'm not going to try and sell you Azure. I'm just trying to tell you what it's capable of. And we're going to start off with part one, where I want to look at actually managing and creating an identity infrastructure. And then we'll look in part two, which will be after a short break, we'll look at actually how we deploy applications to users. We'll do some deployment of application in the first part, but that will be the main access to the second part. And also in the second part, I will be looking at how we reach out and extend to business partners. So B2B, and also to consumers, and how we do that as well, which will be looking at the B2C aspects. So we'll do that in part two. So starting off on part one, a warning first off. Things I show you will change probably to a certain extent. All right, so you might see something in the UI that I show you, and next time you go and look, it's slightly different. It is an evolving platform, and things are changing as we go along. So do be aware of that. And then I'm going to start looking at today's data sort of access challenges. We'll then look at the federation bases. We'll look at modern authentication protocols, Microsoft solutions, and integrating Azure AD and on-premise AD, how we go about that, and then enhancing security. So that's part one. A lot of information to get through. Okay, quick show of hands. How many of you are currently using Azure AD in Office 365? Okay, how many are you using it for other things other than Office 365? Okay, so probably about half the audience with Office 365 and probably less than a third to do other things. And we can discuss in the break the other things you're doing if that would be of interest. So first of all, we're challenged today with resources being absolutely everywhere. And of course, our user wants access to those resources. Now that user may be accessing the resources because they're corporate resources and it's the desire of our organization that they should access them, or they may be personal resources. But the question is, where is the identity stored? And the identity could be in multiple identity stores, which has been the traditional way of doing it. The challenge with that is that you end up using the same username on multiple resources that you go to. And that's particularly, we're pushed in that direction these days, because what do we use for the name?
Email address,
very, very common. So we've given one thing away. So there's a very good chance if we use an email address on one service, it'll be the same email address on another service. And then you end up with the possibly the same password on multiple resources. So confession time, how many of you use the same password on multiple resources that you go to? Okay, so that's less than the statistic is somewhere around 49%, right, of password reuse. And of course, the challenge with password reuse is if someone comes along and steals that identity database, then they've immediately got your username, and which will probably be work on another site, and they've got your password. So as soon as there's been a theft of an identity database, what you'll see is a huge amount of increase in internet traffic of actual attacks. They're trying username and password against those. So hopefully we don't use the same password, but the reality is 49% of people do. And the other factor is that 60% of data breaches that are admitted to are because of password theft. So passwords are a real nuisance. What I want to do is just give you a very, very quick demo of actually looking at a website which is called Have I Been Pwned? How many of you have How many of you know of that website? Okay, so it's about half of you. So let's just have a quick look at that. And I'm going to go, first of all, and have a look to the website itself. And you immediately see an absolutely huge number of pwned. And by pwned, we mean owned accounts. The username and password has been lost. And if we scroll down through this lot, there's the top 10 breaches and the sizes. So there we got 152 million for Adobe accounts that were lost. And carry on down here, you can view all breaches, lots and lots of different data breaches that have happened. But the useful thing actually is if we go down a little bit lower down here, what we'll see is it gives more details. So it gives details, for instance, about the Adobe theft. And in there, the breach, the breach was the internal ID, the username, the email, the encrypted password, right, and a password hint in plain text. Well, a password hint, if it's stolen, gives you a very good idea of how to attack the password. But the cryptography on the passwords was very, very poor. So it was very easy to reverse engineer the password cryptography. And you can carry on going down. It's an interesting site to look at. That is the Ashley Madison website, the Infidelity website. So another confession time. Some of you confessed to password reuse. How many of you had an account on Ashley Madison? No one confessed. Actually, I saw half a hand go up. It was trembling at the time, though. Okay, but a huge amount of information was stolen along with the username and password. And if you're interested in looking at this site in a bit more detail, you can go up and you can put in your email address, and I'm just going to use my standard email address, and to see if it's been pwned at some time, which means the database has been stolen and published on the dark web. And yes, it was, and it was pwned for Dropbox and LinkedIn. Now, some of these attacks happen many years in advance of actually the information being placed on, you know, on a dark site somewhere and being made available. Thing to be aware, of course, people use their favorite passwords. And even if it's 3 years, 5 years old, it still may be a relevant password. So what we can do is by reducing the number of passwords that we use, we can immediately reduce our attack surface. If we look at the statistics, 60% of data breaches due to password leakage. Right? So there's an enormous amount of low-hanging fruit where we can actually increase security. But of course, with our resources, it gets more complicated than users just going to resource. So we've got on-premise resources, we've got partner resources, we've got public cloud, and there you might be using Office 365 or some other SaaS application. You've got private cloud. And then you've got the user, which wants to use any device. And we'll also be using browsers and direct to web APIs. So we've got to be able to cope with that as well. And then we'll have situations where we have multi-hop. So we'll access one server, which may bring back and consolidate data from multiple servers. And what identity are we using to consolidate that data? It could be the server itself is providing the identity, or we might want to delegate the identity using the user's identity. And then we have another situation whereby we have a server which is going to act on behalf of the user when the user's online and also offline. So we need to be able to cope with that as an authentication and authorization scenario. So controlling access is a compromise. And we'll find the user wants no-hassle access. They want it to be easy. Single sign-on is what they would really like. They want to use any device. And at one time, we used to be able to say, you can only use desktop device. But of course, the CEO brings in the iPad, and who's going to tell him he can't use it? And he wants to access the corporate data. They want to feel safe. And what does feeling safe mean? Well, it means that they're prepared to work a little bit harder to access sensitive resources. But you've got to remember, this is what the user considers as sensitive. So if you think of it from a user's perspective, what sort of things might they consider sensitive and be prepared to work a little bit harder for? As a user, what do you do online where you'd like to feel that you're secure?
Online banking.
Bank, yeah. So you might be prepared to use a multi-factor of some kind to go to a bank. right? But the important thing is we need to encourage users and educate them that our corporate data is sensitive. And sometimes they will have to jump through more hoops to get to it. And then administrators want to only allow access for users and devices that they control. Those times have gone, okay? What we need to do is allow access for trusted users. And what do we mean by trusted users these days? It's users who have been identified and verified by an entity that we trust, right? So they've actually been authenticated by someone that we trust. And so the boundary that we're using is becoming authentication. We need to simplify provisioning and deprovisioning, because that's one of the biggest challenges. If you imagine you've got lots of partners you work with, and traditionally, they all had their own identity stores for gaining access to their resources. So we've got John in one organization that needs to access a resource in another, and you'd send an email or you'd fill out a form or do something, and John would get provisioned in the other database. So now John could log in on-prem to your own resources and also to the partner resources, probably using a different password, right? Then John gets fired, all right? So he's now fired, you probably disable his account in your own. But in the partner resource, does the account get disabled? It's always a big challenge, and orphaned accounts are a big challenge. So we need a mechanism whereby users can be provisioned into partners and they can be deprovisioned automatically. We also need to know that our data is secure and compliant, and then we want to control authentication methods and access based on user location. So maybe we want to do something slightly different to someone sitting on the corporate network to someone who's somewhere or maybe in an internet cafe or someone that is identified at being on site, so a customer network. We'd like to be able to control it based on device type and the state of the device. So are they using an iOS device? Are they using, you know, a Windows device of some kind? We might want to change how we do the authentication. And then, is the device compliant? And for that, what we'll be doing is using mobile desktop management to check the compliance of the device. And if you're using a compliant device, you're coming from the correct resource, or you're going to the correct resource, correct location, we might let you in. On the other hand, we might push you to using multi-factor. And then application sensitivity. So for one application, we don't require multi-factor. For another, we do. And we want to be able to automatically do that. And then in terms of user and risk profile, this is where we want to really be able to look at the users and the user's behavior. So have they suddenly logged on in America? And then did they log on in China? And then did they log on immediately short time later in Russia? And was their surname Trump? In which case, we might want to impose different access policies. So we need to be able to analyze that type of information. So what we end up with are resources, could be anywhere. Partner network, our own network, some private cloud somewhere, absolutely anywhere. Our users could be any type of user, a user from our own organization, a partner, a customer, and using any type of device. And then we might have the identity store, which is our own user, is defined in our own organization's identity store, might be a partner's identity store, a third-party enterprise identity provider. And of course, one of those third-party identity providers is Microsoft Azure AD. Right? But there are lots of them. Or it could be that we just need to know about the user, we're prepared to let them use a Google identity or a Microsoft account identity, so a social identity provider of some kind. Somehow, we need to join this lot together. And that's where we use federation. And the definition, what does federation mean? If you look at it, if it's from the Latin trust, okay? What we're doing is establishing trust. So where our applications are going to trust identity that has been provided by a particular identity provider. So Federation should give us an identity framework that can be consumed by all applications and services, regardless of where they are. Okay? If you take today a server, which is part of your Active Directory, and you move that server to the cloud, right, no one's going to be able to log in using Active Directory credentials to that server unless you somehow replicate your Active Directory up to the cloud as well. Okay? What we want to be able to do is, how do you log onto the server? Same way here as you do there, as you do there. Okay? And then we want one set of user credentials giving you SSO to all websites and services. And that would be a very nice way to go. And solution obviously has got to be built on industry standards, and we need support for browsers, but equally well, these days, what we need is support for web API calls, because most mobile apps will be calling web APIs. So that support for browser, which is referred to as a passive profile, or web API, or web services, an active profile. And what would be nice is if we going to have an identity system would be that we have it handle password resets for us. It allows us to do self-servicing, and that self-servicing could be group membership, it could be allocation to applications, it could be that we're completely self-serviced and we can join that identity store just through email verification. MFA, built in, that's what we need, so multi-factor authentication. A method to do enrollment, provisioning, and deprovisioning of users, not just in that identity store, but against all applications which are associated with that identity store. And then conditional access, so, you know, based on a profile of some kind. Detailed reporting and auditing as well is very, very important to us. And then, when you've got huge amounts of reporting that's coming in, lots of audit information, what you want is a method where that information can be data mined. So some form of identity protection system would be a nice feature to add in as well. But what I want to do is start with the Federation basics. And just to give you a sort of introduction to this, I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail, but the idea is we have our user who wants to access an application. So we've got application X down there. What the user will do is he will go to a security token service and he will request a token that will prove his authentication to application X. So what we'll need to do is authenticate that user. So it could be that that security token service authenticates the user, or it could be saying, well, I can't authenticate you, but I know someone who might be able to, and it might pass you to another security token service. But ultimately, the user is authenticated, and then a token is crafted, okay? This is, in some ways, very similar to Kerberos. With Kerberos, we go to a Kerberos server and say, please, can I have a token to server X? And it gives us back a token for server X. But the token structure for server X and server Y, server Z, are all the same, just crammed full of all your groups and everything else. How many of you suffered token explosion? Okay, just a few hands, okay? That Kerberos token can get way big, too big. So what we're doing here is we're crafting a token specifically for the application. So it means our security token service needs to know about the application. And it then gets presented to the app, and the app accepts that token as proof of authentication because the token is digitally signed with a signature the app is happy with. Right, in Kerberos, you've got to be a member of the domain to be able to validate any of the Kerberos session tickets. Now, all we need to do is to be able to validate that actual token by checking the signature. So we just need to know how it was cryptographically signed. What's on that token? Anything you like. I say anything you like. It's actually what the STS is capable of putting on it for you. So you will have some choices. How many of you use ADFS? Okay, for those who are using ADFS, I would say it's pretty much whatever you like on that token. But if you're using a different security token service, you will be constrained as to what you can put on the token. Okay, but there are other ways of finding out information. So there's a simplified flow. What actually happens is we hit the claims app, knock, knock, knock on the door, and the first thing the claims app will do is say, are you authenticated? And how would we prove authentication to that claims app? If we were coming back to that app, we'd already been there. How could we prove that we were already authenticated?
Cookie.
Cookie, yes, well done. So if we've got a cookie that says we're authenticated to the app, lets us straight in, okay? If not, it says, okay, I don't do authentication, but I do trust a security token service that does do authentication. So it redirects you up to the security token service. Okay, remember, this is a user in a browser. So this is going to be absolutely standard HTTP protocols carried by HTTPS. So they're always going to be in a TLS channel, so a secure channel. So we get a redirect to the STS. So next thing is, who are you? What's your password? Do we need for you to do multi-factor, whatever other mechanisms we need? We authenticate that user, and we generate a security token service that's digitally signed by that STS. That gets represented back to the Claims Aware application, and the Claims Aware application will take the token, it will validate it, and if it's happy with it, and there's lots of bits of validation, is number one, is the token for me? Is the token valid in terms of time period? And also, is the signature valid? If it's valid, what it will do is it will return cookies and the page. Next time you go knock, knock, knocking on the server door, you just chuck the cookies back in and you're straight there. You don't have to redo the dance. Now, if you're not familiar with this, we've got the sort of protocol flow that actually happens. We can actually see using Fiddler. And we can go into Fiddler itself and start it up. And I'll talk about that in a second. And I'm going to go to a claims app. And what we're doing is knocking on the door. It centers up to our security token service, which happens to be Azure AD. Can I get the password right? And there we are. We've got back a web page with the claims that were put on it by the security token service. In this case, it was Azure AD. So not a huge amount of useful information, but we can see the name of the guy is Tor. His display name is Tor. The identity provider, this GUID here, identifies what's referred to your directory in Azure. It's referred to as the tenant. So that's identifying your tenant in Azure. And what we can do is we can actually look at what happened by looking at Fiddler. And looking with Fiddler, if we just stop it, and let's just take it as a very high-level picture first. We hit the claims app, and the claims app says, you're not authenticated, and so it sends us up to Azure. We bounce around a few times with Azure, but there's no point in looking at any of that traffic because that's Microsoft proprietary, and they may change it at any time. What we're interested in is what comes back from Azure and what gets sent back to the claims application. So if we split open that first of all, so we're off to the claims app, we get a redirect, and in that redirect, we have a request to Azure. Let's just grab that. It's URL decoded, and I'm going to pop that into Notepad so we can see it more clearly. And having popped it into Notepad, we can break it up into its constituent parts. The first thing is we call the login endpoint. The next thing is we say what we want to do, which is sign in the user. The next thing is we declare the realm. That is the application. So this is what we're saying is sign this user in, which is the first thing is the W sign in. Sign the user in for this application, which is the realm. The WCTX in there is a way of holding state. Because if you imagine, we come knocking on the door of the server, and the server says, go off to Azure and get authenticated. And you're going to come back from Azure with a token. And what we need to do is tie up the redirect, which said go off to Azure, with the token that comes back. And we use the state variable to do that. And that's what the WCTX is. The WCT is just a timestamp. Okay, so this is to give you a rough idea of how this works. We then go off, and having gone there, we go through, we're up to Azure, and the important one is coming back. Now, when we come back, we get a 200 OK with a whole raft of cookies set. These cookies say that you're authenticated to Azure. So we hit one app, up to Azure, back it comes, and that bit gets finished. But then if we hit another app, which is hanging off Azure already, we go up to Azure, and this time, immediately, we present the cookies to Azure, and we got single sign-on to the second app. Hit the third app, exactly the same thing happens. So now we're into a single sign-on operation that's going on. So we get this 200 OK back, and if we have a look at that, what we can do is just decode the body of that. And if we look at it, first of all, in web view, we see all it has is a submit button, which is a bit odd. But actually, what's come back is a hidden form. And that hidden form, if we look at it in text view, we can actually see with the hidden form, we have a, it's there, the input type is hidden. And what happens when we click the submit button is we get a post. So that's the post back. And where does it post it back to? It posts us back to a URL redirect address, which is our application. What does it post back? It posts back all of this stuff here, which some of it's in XML, some of it's encrypted, and what it's got in here is all our claims. So there we've got a user here, we've got the name, and we've got our user Tor at 5.users. Down the bottom of this, what we'll see is we have a submit button and input type submit, and below it is a bit of JavaScript to actually do the submission. So that's what comes back. That gets posted back to the claims app. The claims app opens it up, it validates the token, and then it sets cookies to say you're authenticated. And having set those cookies, it gives us a redirect back to the app, and then we finally go back to the app itself. So if we go back to the app, what we'll see there is a 200 OK, and that is our website that's come back. Now, what I really wanted to get across in looking at this is you can see all this on the wire. So if you have a problem, and you do have problems, especially when working with partners and things, of actually getting it set up, just by looking at what's on the wire, you can troubleshoot it really, really quickly. And if you're interested in getting into all of that, you've already seen that the masterclass brochure, we spend a lot of time troubleshooting so that when you deploy an app, if it doesn't work the way you expect it to, rather than going through all the settings here, because there are settings up in the cloud, the setting or settings in the STS, the settings in the application, just look at the trace, and within minutes, you can troubleshoot it and fix it. Okay, so enterprise versus consumer protocols. Traditionally, SAMLP has been used as protocol. WS Star, which is WS Fed, WS Federation. Microsoft were absolute champions of WS Federation. They used it extensively for SharePoint, for ClaimsAware and SharePoint. Those protocols are still here. They're still around. They're used in the enterprise all over the place. You may have to interface with them. But the modern protocols are OAuth2 and OpenID Connect. OAuth2 is a protocol that's used for delegated access. And OpenID Connect layers on top of that as an authentication protocol. They were originally consumer protocols, but are now being adopted in the enterprise. And you've probably seen Microsoft referring to modern authentication protocols. That's what they're referring to. So I just want to spend a little bit of time looking at those modern authentication protocols. So if we're looking at enterprise today, what you'll probably find is in terms of accessing a front-end web application and authenticating against it, you may authenticate against it using WSFed, you may authenticate against it using SAMLP or OpenID Connect, right? And in fact, there's a lot of WSFed still within the Microsoft space, okay? And then when you go from that app to a back end, it's almost invariably OAuth2 that is now used as the protocol. If you're coming from a mobile device, so we're coming in from a mobile device itself, so we're running a native app on our mobile device, what you'll have is the way that the device gets information to display from you is by calling web APIs. And for that, it will be using OAuth2. And what it will be doing is getting a token, probably with your identity, right, which gives it access to a web API. Most web APIs are now written as a REST API, which means they're stateless. So every time we call the API, we have to pass in the header an authentication, right? And in that header, it's referred to as a bearer token. It's an access token that gets passed every single time because we don't get a cookie back as state, right? So every time we'll be passing that bearer token across. If you're coming from a server, you may come with the identity of a user or you may come with the identity of the server itself. Again, probably using OAuth2. And then we go to the back end using OAuth2. Now I say the industry is moving in this direction. You may well find WS Trust and all sorts of other things there. But ultimately you will find, especially when you're calling REST APIs, it will be using OAuth2. So where did OAuth2 come from? And it was really designed to solve a problem. How does a user allow application A, right, to access a resource that the user owns, which is protected by application B? So we have a resource server, which is application B, which has maybe got some data that the user owns. And what we want is to allow that user to give permission to server A to access the data in their identity, right? And of course, one of the solutions, and the simplest solution, is simply give application A your username and password for application B. Comfortable with that? Probably not, okay? Because what they can do is they can go and they got full access to that other service. And what we want to do is to be able to get permission to do certain things to the resources. It is surprising how often you still see this done, all right? But we don't want to be there. So OAuth2 was devised as a framework to provide a solution for delegating, meaning that application A can use the identity of the user to go to application B, right? But it's using the identity of the user. That's the delegation piece. But we also want to be able to control and limit access, which is where consent comes in. So what we want is the user to consent that application A is allowed to do certain things to resources on B using their identity. So that's really what OAuth is about. And of course, I've actually written OAuth there. It should be OAuth2. OAuth2 is not compatible with OAuth. OpenID Connect, which is used for authenticating the user, is totally not compatible with OpenID. So we're talking OpenID Connect and we're talking OAuth2. Authentication with OAuth2, what happened is there were various parties said, look, I've got a token which the user got by signing in. Therefore, I'll use it as the user's identity. Right? Imagine a front-end server and a back-end server. Right? The user gives this server permission to access that server using their identity to a limited extent. Right? So an access token is generated. an access token which will allow that access here. One of the very, very important things is on that access token is the audience. The audience for that token is this backend server. But people thought, we've got a token. We'll use it to show that the user's authenticated to this server. And there are all sorts of horrendous hacks you can do if you take that. And there were various social media companies that absolutely did that, and they ended up with their systems being hacked. So what they did is they layered a proprietary protocol on top of OAuth 2. That proprietary protocol has now turned into OpenID Connect. So how do we authenticate to this service? OpenID Connect. We get an ID token. The audience on that ID token is this server. How do we go from this server to a backend server? We're using OAuth 2, and we get an access token, right? And the audience on that access token is this guy here. Okay. So if we just have a very, very quick look at that, what I can do is I can show you a demo environment that I use. And I'm going to OIDC Azure, and that's an anonymous page. I'm going to sign in with Hybrid Flow, and we're going to sign in here as Tor. So we're up to Azure AD. We're signing in as Tor, and we're going to get a couple of things back. We're going to get back an ID token, and on that ID token, the very, very important thing is the audience. It's who it's for. So that's my application. The issuer there is sts.windows.net, and that is my tenant ID, and there's various other bits and pieces, which I'm not going to go into the detail here. Now, along with this ID token, we got back a code. So the ID token is proving authentication to this front end. The code allows this front end server to request an access token to a back end server. And I can request that code, and I can convert it, so we can actually go and convert the code. And when we do a code conversion, we actually get the ID token back again, plus we get this bearer token. And the bearer token, the audience on the bearer token, is my api.example.com. It's my backend API. So, and it says bearer, and why does it say bearer? Because it's born in the header as proof of authentication. So when we make the REST request to the back end, this will be proof of authentication. Now, the other challenge that we're faced with is there are lots and lots and lots of different ways of cutting this authentication because we have lots of different types of clients. Okay, so we have a browser, right, in its simplest form. So browser wants to authenticate against that web app, and what we'll do is we'll use, if we're using a modern authentication protocol, we'll use OpenID Connect. And then you have a SPAR app, which is a single page application. It's in the browser, but it's running as JavaScript. So what happens is the browser connects to the web server pushes back into the browser a whole bunch of JavaScript, and then everything is done using the JavaScript. Right? That JavaScript may well want to call backend web APIs to get data, so it can render the data to you. And to be able to do that, it will need an access token. Okay? Now, it can't get back a code and translate the access token because we don't trust the SPAR. SPAR's running in the browser. So we give it a limited access token that it gets back. And provided the user's still there, we can refresh the token. There's a mechanism for doing that. But as soon as the user goes, then that SPAR cannot refresh that token. So the token will time out. We need to deal with that situation. We've got a native or mobile app. So this is an app running maybe on our mobile, maybe running natively on a desktop. It gets distributed. We can't trust that with a secret either. So it has to behave in a different way. This guy, the web app, all right, at the top, we can trust with a secret because he's in a nice controlled environment. All right, we deployed the application on it, we configured it, we set the secret. That's fine. So it can convert codes to tokens. It can have refresh tokens, so it can refresh its access tokens because we trust it, right? Native app absolutely can't trust it because we're going to distribute it so that anyone can reverse engineer it, and we were distributing it with a secret in it, they could find that secret out. Okay, so that has to be dealt with differently. And then we might have a daemon or a service, and what that's doing is it's calling maybe a web API using its own identity, so the identity of that service. And we need to be able to work with all of these. Now, the modern authentication protocols, so OpenID Connect, OAuth2, will handle all of these situations. But there's a number of different types of flows you can have. One of the flows is hybrid flow. And this is a combination of OpenID Connect and OAuth2. So we come knocking on the server door, and the server says you're not authenticated and redirects you up to Azure or an STS that will handle this. And we're going to an authorization endpoint. So at this point, we get authenticated. And then what it will do is it will issue cookies to say you've been authenticated. It will issue an ID token that can be used to identify you to the front-end server, and it will issue back a code. Those arrive back into the browser, right, as a page, so 200 OK with a submit button down the bottom, which is automated. That gets pushed back to the application or the web application. It's now got the ID token, which proves the identity of the user. So it now authenticates the user based on that. And then what it has is a code that it can make a request to an STS and say, look, I've got this code, please give me an access token to a backend resource. And depending how everything is configured, it will get that access token. So now it's got an access token, and it goes to the backend resource and returns whatever it wants to do to the front-end browser. Right? So it's just a little, it's very, very, very similar to WSFed, very similar to SAML. It just gives you a whole lot more flexibility. And when you get back an access token, if you are a trusted client or trusted application, you'll also get back a refresh token, so you can refresh it as well. So, question I always get asked is, so which protocol should we be using? And the answer is, whatever protocol you need to use. If you're working with a partner and they are using Federation or WS Trust, or they're using SAMLP as a protocol, you'll have to use that to interface with them. Right? But if you're developing a new app, right, you're calling REST APIs, developing something absolutely new, your development effort should go on the modern authentication protocols, which is OpenID Connect and OAuth2. So that's where your focus should actually be. But SAML WS Federation will be around for years, probably very little innovation in that space. Whereas the modern protocols, you will find there will be innovation. So Microsoft solution, what have they got to offer us in terms of solutions? So in terms of Microsoft, they have a server 2016 ADFS and Microsoft Azure AD. So both of those platforms support WS Federation, SAML, OAuth2, and OpenID Connect. Now, if you go for Windows Server 2012 R2 ADFS, there is very limited support for OAuth2. There is absolutely no support for OpenID Connect. So you will have to go for 2016 ADFS to do that. If we look at the actual spec, you may well find if you read the specs in detail, and they're all published in RFCs, the specs, if you look at them for OpenID, Connect, and OAuth2, you may find features that are actually not implemented in the STS. These are framework definitions, so not everything has to be implemented. If we look at ADFS as an STS, what it will do is it will authenticate a user, and it'll authenticate a user against AD on-prem. It will also, if you're using a 2016 ADFS, it will authenticate against an LDAP v3 compliant directory. And the nice thing about it, of course, AD is an LDAP v3 compliant directory. So you can authenticate against users held in a completely untrusted forest, if that's what you wanted to do. It's a good feature that they've introduced. Actually, anyone use it in earlier versions of ADFS? Anyone use the LDAP store? It was there and Microsoft took it out and finally they put it back in again, which is very useful. What it will do is it will produce you security tokens and it will produce you security tokens for applications. And those security tokens could be for SAML, they could be for WSFed, or they could be OpenID Connect ID tokens or OAuth2 access tokens. All right. And you can also prove authentication of a user. So if you go off to another STS and that STS authenticates you, it can produce a token which can be proof of authentication of a user to our STS, so our ADFS server. And then it exposes lots of endpoints, and those endpoints are allowing you to call the different protocol endpoints. And of course, it's using HTTPS. HTTPS is really, really important for us. So we're using TLS as transport layer security to secure the channel. Infrastructure to support it, there's a lot of it. You need at least two ADFS servers. If you're going to expose anything to the internet, you need at least two ADFS web application proxies in front of it. And then you decide on what the configuration database is and all the rest of it, and you've got to maintain it and look after it. So it's quite a large infrastructure to support. If you look at Microsoft Azure AD, then what you've got is it's a multi-tenant service. And you will be a tenant sitting up in the Azure AD space, okay? And everything's looked after you for you except the data in your AD. So what you'll be doing is you will be adding users either from one of the portals. There are currently two management portals. One is being retired, hopefully this year, and we'll be using the new portal. At the moment, Azure AD is moving across. It's nearly all the way across into the new portal, but sometimes you have to go and fix something in the old portal. It's a little bit tricky with the portals at the moment. You've got REST APIs, and you've got Graph APIs you can call. You can call it with PowerShell, okay? And you can take users from on-prem AD and synchronize them up into the cloud. So once they're up there, what can you do with them? You can make them available so that they can access a whole plethora of different applications. So the Azure subscription, Office 365, applications from gallery. Microsoft, there are over 2,000 applications sitting in a gallery ready for you to integrate with. And then you can have your own apps and you can have partner apps that you can integrate with. So now we get a user who logs in to Azure AD and suddenly they've got a single sign-on to a huge number of applications. We'll have to see how that, in part two, I will actually go through how that single sign-on works. But infrastructure to support Azure AD is an Azure AD subscription. And actually, to a certain extent, with a new portal, you don't even need that. You can do limited things through the new portal without an Azure subscription. So you can start using it. There are different flavors, and I'm not going to go through all the details of the different flavors, but you've got a free version, which is limited on the number of objects and limited on the number of applications you can do single sign-on to, so 10 apps. If you've got Office 365, you already have an Azure AD, so it's similar to the basic version, which gives you no object limit, it gives you an SLA, and then there are two premium versions. And the main difference is premium two, notice that premium two adds identity protection and privilege identity management. Premium One has advanced reporting and self-service. So they're all adding on top of each other. At last, Microsoft put a really nice table up on their website where you can actually go and look at all the different options that are available. But if you want to get off, start experimenting with things, you can go for free. You can then go for a trial subscription, maybe a P2, Premium 2, try it out, do some testing, decide what you want, what you need. Okay, how do we create a Zero AD tenant? Well, if you have Office 365, you already have a tenant. But the Office 365 management portal is really focused on doing Office 365 style things. If you want to open up, start using the app gallery and all the rest of it, you'll have to go to the new Azure portal. Alternatively, you create your own AD. And when you create it, what you'll end up with is you choose a tenant name. And it has to be unique across all tenants. And if it's not unique, it will tell you. So you create it, you've got a unique name, which is unique across all tenants. Doesn't matter terribly what that name is, but you are stuck with it forever, right? But you may never see it because you'll add your own domains up there as well. But having done that, your very first user you create will be user at yourtenantname.onmicrosoft.com. But then you will add your own domains, and then you can create users based on your own domain names. The two Azure portals, there's the old portal, or as Microsoft likes it to be referred to as the classic portal, right? And there's the new portal, which is shown on the right-hand side, which is all very clever piece of HTML5, and that's everything is moving into the new portal, and the classic portal will probably be retired later this year. Right. Question?
That was the question I was going to ask.
As to when it will be retired?
Migration complete.
Yeah, as soon as they possibly can, I think is the answer. Exactly when, though, but it will be hopefully by the end of the year. As I say, at the moment, you can do things in the new portal, and there's more and more functionality. You can pretty much do everything in the new portal, but sometimes you do something in the new portal, and it doesn't work. And rather than tearing your hair out, go to the old portal, disable it, re-enable it, and it'll probably kick into life. This has only happened with the latest things that have been ported. So, for instance, self-service for applications sometimes doesn't work. But if you go to the old portal, disable it, re-enable it, it goes. So you have to be aware that you have to work with both portals at the moment. Okay, so let's have a quick look at the Azure portal itself. And what I'm going to do is just give you a very quick tour. So this is my user logged in, and this user has access to a number of different directories. So MSC4A, MSC BBC, and so on. And we're just going to work with the 4A directory. So we go to the Azure Active Directory blade, and we've got a number of options. Number one, let's look at domain names. So what we've got is the xtsmsc4a.onmicrosoft.com. That was the initial directory, so the tenant name is xtsmsc4a, and then I've added two new domains in to be verified. And the domain naming is rather strange, but we use it in the masterclass so that I can actually allocate, you know, 5.users.xtshub.com, 6.users, and everyone has their own domain. And I just keep going up and up and up in numbers so that when you take away your directory, you know that domain will never be used anywhere else. So you can keep it in there if you want to. Okay, so that's the domain names. If we have a look at company branding, this is where we can brand the portal, which is what I've done. Shows it rather strangely. It's not black, it's transparent, but it comes out as black. So that's the branding that's there. Close that off. If we go to users in here and groups, we can have a look at all users. And what we've got is all users that have come up. If I go add columns in here and choose source of authority, what we can see is that we've actually got now we've got Azure Active Directory, so that's defined in this Azure Active Directory, but Windows Server AD means it's defined in my on-premise server, and it's been replicated up here, so it's been synchronized. So Harry Lime is from my on-premise AD. James Bond is from my on-premise AD. These guys, Benny and Bentozo, these guys are actually external users, but I will talk a bit more about external users in the part two. So that's a way of seeing the different types of users. If I want to add someone, I can add them, I can configure their profile, I could, for instance, give them a directory role, and I can make them a global administrator, or the other alternative is a limited administrator, which allows me to do delegation of admin. If I go down to in here, let's close that off for a second, and what I want to do is enterprise applications. These are where I assign applications to users, and we're going to come back on that later on. But if we just look at all applications there, what I can see is I've got a claims app, I've got a proxy, I've got Graph Explorer, LinkedIn, etc. And these are the applications that can be made available to users, and I can choose which users they're available to. Okay, if I want to integrate Azure AD and on-premises AD, then what I'm going to be doing is having to make some choices. So I have a user, which is an on-prem user, who will log in on-prem using a certain username and a certain password. I can then go from my on-premise directory and decide what to sync up into Azure AD. So I could sync users and groups, in which case what's going to happen is we could have a different username and we will definitely have a different password to what's used on premises. When you synchronize up, what you've got to do is you've got to synchronize a unique suffix, right, which is a DNS suffix. And if you've got your UPNs on premises configured at xyz.local, you cannot sync it, right? Because it has to be a rootable DNS suffix, right? So you, what you'll have to do, the best way is to update your on-premise UPNs, right? So to something that can be verified up in Azure AD. That is the best possible way, best possible solution. If you really can't do that, and the reasons may not really exist as to why you really can't do it, but what people are worried about is application compatibility. And they say, no, no, we can't do this because it might break things. What you can do is use an alternate attribute. And the alternate attribute, the recommended one, is email address, right? Because you've got an email address, it will be a rootable DNS suffix. And that's what we sync up. But what will happen is, on-prem, you'll have the UPN to log in, and now you're using the email address to log into Azure. Not a particularly nice situation. So I do highly recommend updating your on-prem UPNs, right, to be rootable or DNS rootable suffix. You can synchronize your users' passwords and groups. And when you say synchronize passwords, what it's doing is your password's stored in your own AD as a hash. It's a hash of the hash that's synchronized. One of the problems is when a database of passwords gets stolen, if it's a straightforward hash that was up there, it's possible that we can reverse engineer it using rainbow tables to get back the password. It's also possible if you store hashes, you could attack directly on premises using those hashes. What's actually up there is a hash of a hash. Right, which is, so if the database got stolen out of the cloud, it would be useless on premises. So it's actually quite safe to use the hash of the hash up there. But a lot of people say, no way, security officer says, no way Microsoft having my passwords. Right? So they stay on prem. So, but if you did synchronize your hash, you could use the same username, same password. So it's not single sign-on, but it's same sign-on. Another method is where we sync users and groups with SSO. And with SSO, what we're saying is this user is a federated user, right? And when you attempt to log in as that user, what will happen is you will be redirected down to your on-premise ADFS infrastructure. Right? So now we're logging in on-premises to an ADFS. Right? Problem with that is, of course, we need the ADFS infrastructure. You know, it's not just the servers, it's the maintenance and everything else that we need to deal with. But that's a possibility. The last possibility and the newest possibility is where we use the same username and password, right? But when we come knocking on the Azure door, Azure gathers our username and password and passes that down through a secure channel to an endpoint, right, in our own environment, and that endpoint authenticates the user against on-premise AD. And if authentication is successful, the endpoint tells Azure AD that, yep, successful authentication. And this is referred to as pass-through authentication. It's currently in preview. So those are the options for actually doing the authentication of our users with Azure AD and users synchronized up from on-premise AD. If you've got credentials in your AD, what's going to happen is you come to an app. It's going to send you, because that app trusts Azure AD, sends you up to Azure AD. Azure AD asks you for your username. So you type your username, john@blahblah.com, and it says, blahblah.com is a federated domain. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you down to the STS, the security token service, associated with that domain. So we get redirected down to on-prem. So this home realm discovery is where we decide that we're going to send you down there by gathering your login name. So we're being authenticated by our on-premise ADFS server, and we get back a token. That token is proof of authentication of the user, but who's the token for who consumes that token? Is it any use to the application?
The Azure AD.
Yeah, it's Azure AD. Application knows nothing about it. The application trusts Azure AD. Azure AD trusts our security token service. So we get back the token, we present it to Azure AD, processes the token, and returns a token for consumption by our application. So we now send the token to the app, it validates the token, returns the page, and we get the cookies back as well. And of course, for all that to work, we need to be able to identify that user as being a federated user, so we're going to have to synchronize our users from our on-premise AD. How do we do the synchronization? We use AD Connect these days. And the sort of precursors to AD Connect were DirSync, Azure AD Sync, FIM or MIM if you like, and the Azure AD Connector, and now Azure AD Connect has replaced all of that. And not only does it manage everything, including now in preview, pass-through authentication and single sign-on, but it also deploys health agents. So there's an Azure AD Connect health agent, which will go on your Azure AD Connect, which will report the actual health of the connector into Azure AD, and we can monitor it in the portal. But you can also report the health of your ADFS servers. You can also report the health of your AD directory services. So now you have a single point where the health is being monitored of all of your identity services. Because, you know, if you're using Azure AD, that's already being monitored. So now we've got everything in one single location. And the way we get to it is we use the Azure AD Connect Health Portal. Question I always get is to federate or not. Should we federate? And the problem is, were you told to by someone at some point in time? Did you really think it through? I would say, unless you have an absolutely compelling reason to federate using SSO to on-premise ADFS, don't do it. All right? What do we gain if we do it? we do gain SSO, right? So if we've got a desktop within on-premise in our own corporate network, and our user goes up to the Azure AD, gets redirected down to our on-premise STS servers, we can pass the credentials straight through to that STS. So you do have single sign-on to Azure AD completely. Right? That argument has been weakened a little bit by the new SSO preview, which I will talk about in a moment. The other thing is on-premise authentication policies. Now, the only real on-premise authentication policy that you can't emulate in Azure AD is, does anyone know what it is? To do with time.
Time-based.
Log-on times. Yeah. You can't actually do that. So, at the moment, right, whether you'll be able to do it shortly, I couldn't talk about. But, so if you need to do that, and there are some countries that you need to do it, right, because the workers are not allowed to log in outside office hours, right? So, ADFS. On-premise authentication method. So, you've bought in and you've got a multi-factor mechanism of some kind, and you want to stick with it. ADFS, all right? But, maybe Azure multi-factor would do it for you, all right? On-premise, the on-premise conditional access policy. Now, this was a very strong argument a few months ago, or maybe, it is literally a few months ago. ADFS on-prem would give you better conditional access than Azure AD. Azure AD conditional access is really, really good now. Okay, so that weakens that argument. And then if you do decide to federate, then you need on-premise ADFS infrastructure with high availability. So you've got to build it. Do you geolocate it? All right. What do you do about your internet connection into your company? Because you imagine that you've got hundreds of home workers who are all using something like Office 365, other SaaS apps, and everything else, and suddenly your on-prem internet connection goes down, right? None of them can log in anymore, right? So a quick panic method and disabling federation and all sorts of bits and pieces. So you really need a high availability on the internet connection as well. So it's something to seriously consider. Do you really need ADFS on-prem? It's there if you want it, but you may not need it. New is pass-through authentication. So this is where you come knocking on the door of Azure AD. And what it does, it passes your credentials down through a connector, through a secure channel to on-premise. Okay. And by the way, that connector is built on the same connector that's used in the web application proxy. And coming from on-prem, where the endpoint is, you only make outbound connections. So when I said it passes the information through, yes, it does, but everything is outbound from on-premises. Okay. And the PTA agent can run on multiple servers, so you've got fault tolerance on that. Say, that is currently in preview. The next thing that's currently in preview is SSO. And SSO is their single sign-on. However, today you have to give a hint. You have to supply the username. As soon as you supply the username, single sign-on happens. Right? Once a hint can be passed from the browser to Azure AD, we could have single sign-on without any requirement to supply anything. And single sign-on is maturing as we go. So there will be changes to it. They're both in preview today. There's limited support for single sign-on as well in terms of which operating systems are used. The other thing to bear in mind is that your machine has got to be domain joined, right? Because actually what it does, it uses Kerberos to sign into Azure AD, right? And there's no time to get into the details of that today. But You know, you're not set in stone. Anytime you want to change any of this, then you can simply go in and make the appropriate changes. So this is the reconfiguration of user sign-in in the Azure AD Connect. Okay, so in terms of enhancing user security, what we've got is we've got password policies that we can set. We've got MFA for users based on conditional access policies, which I will come to in a bit more detail in a second. Right? So it's not just, oh, these users must have MFA. We can make it based on a conditional access. We've got role-based delegated administration, so we don't have to have, you know, one all-powerful administrator. We can delegate administration. We've got privileged identity management, which means you don't have to have administrative powers at all. You could be an administrator, but you can be given the powers when needed, and they can be taken away again when you don't need them. So if you've come across PAM, privileged access management, in on-prem AD, this is sort of similar to that. You've got administrative units. So if you're familiar with having OUs in your on-premise AD and doing delegation over an OU, so you know somebody can reset all the passwords for those users in a particular OU. What you can do is you can create AUs, or administrative units, and do the delegation over those administrative units. Self-service password resets is another thing that comes out the box. Device compliance and conditional access. If you want to do device compliance, you need an MDM. You need an MDM solution. And of course, there's Intune, but there are other third-party solutions that you can use. So mobile desktop management. And then identity protection, which is actually a very, very powerful engine, which will help with your security. And if we look at that, what it's doing, it's monitoring for anomalies and suspicious events. And we've got reporting, we've got investigation and remediation, and we've got risk-based conditional access. It requires Premium 2. So we have to have Premium 2 for this to work. And it's using machine learning. So it's learning all the time. So examples of detection and risk is you've got a risk event type, use of elite credentials, boom. What it's done is the dark websites have been trawled, and suddenly your username and password has appeared in the dark web. Immediately, you're flagged as high risk, okay? If you've got sign-in from anonymous IP addresses, and what's an anonymous IP address? You're coming out the back end of a torrent tunnel. Why are you doing that for your sign-in? Maybe you're trying to hide the fact that you're signing in, and that will be flagged as a risk, and that's flagged as a medium risk. Impossible travel. So this is where, you know, you're logging in London, Dubai, somewhere else within seconds. Of course, that could be normal behavior because you might have VPN outlets in all of those locations. So what it will do is it will learn your behaviors, right? Another one is sign in from unfamiliar locations. Again, it's learning your behavior. Sign in from infected devices. That's only flagged as a low risk because Microsoft don't know that your device is infected. What it knows is your device is using an IP address that has been associated with a command and control for NetBots. All right? And of course, that IP address could be, you could be sitting behind a proxy, and there are thousands of machines. So somebody's probably infected, but it may not be you. So it's flagged as low risk. But basically, what you can do is you can make decisions based on the risk. And you could say that if you're high risk, immediately you're blocked. You can't get in, right? Or you could say you could have reset your password, and you've got to use multi-factor. Right, so you can make those sort of decisions. So let's just have a quick look at a conditional access policy. And I've actually got a conditional access policy at the moment, which we'll look at, which is my MFA conditional access policy. So we'll just clear off some of this junk and get down here. And there we are, conditional access. and I have this MFA policy in here. Let's open it up and have a look. And the first thing is, who do we assign it to? Okay, so I've just assigned this to, I could assign it to users or group. I've assigned it to one user, David Grimm. Okay, so that's who it's assigned to. Next question is, does it apply to all apps or does it apply to one particular app? And I've decided to select the app, and I'm using the Microsoft Azure subscription, which is the actual portal, okay? Next thing is, we have a condition on there. And again, what I can do is decide whether what is the condition. So what is, we can choose the sign-in risk. So what have you been flagged as? Okay, so have you been flagged as high, medium, low, or no risk? And currently it's not configured, but we can make that choice. Next thing, device platform. What platform are you using? Are you using Android, iOS, Windows Phone? They've still put Windows Phone in there, it's amazing. And then we got Windows, and then we could go for location. And I've chosen to configure this one, and I've said all locations, okay? And then in terms of the client app, are we using a browser? Are we using a mobile app? Or in terms of it, we can set it for Exchange Active Sync. So if you match all of these conditions, what are we going to do with you? We're going to come in here under the control, and we're going to go, we're going to grant access, but we're going to require multi-factor. So if you're David Grimm, and you are using the portal, and you're coming from any device, we want, well, any location, we want you to use multi-factor. Okay, so let's experience this from David's perspective. So David's going to log in. So we need to a new user in there. So again, it's David, and again, it's a strange username, but it's fine. 5.users.xtshub.com. And we need David's password. And I've gone into the My Apps. This is the access control panel. And this is where we make apps available to users. I'll talk more about this in part two. And what we're going to do now is actually go from here. He's logged into Azure, but we're going to go to the portal. And immediately, he's being challenged for multi-factor. So we need to get his verification code, 2795. Okay, sign into that. And now we're logged on. So we logged in to the access panel. So he logged in quite happily into Azure AD. But as soon as he used that particular cloud app, he was forced to basically step up his authentication by using multi-factor. Okay, let's switch that. So what have we achieved? We have got now basically a mechanism to give us authentication without boundaries. So where's the app sit? Doesn't matter, right? If we're using one of the federated protocols, it really doesn't matter. We've got a robust IDS, or identity as a service, and we've reduced passwords, because once we've logged in there once, right, we've got access to all of our applications, and we'll see that after the break. So now we got the one password. So we can have a really strong, secure password, put in multi-factor as well, okay? Your chances of the Azure Active Directory being attacked is probably very, very, attacked all the time. But actually, that database of your username and passwords being stolen is probably very slim. Right? And it's also highly protected as well. Okay, so you've got a very robust base, but you do have one password. And the problem is, with one password, however good, it can never be stolen. It's a good, strong password, so it can never be used for an online attack, because you'll never, you know, never be able to attack using that password. Well, you'll never guess the password for an online. So offline, very unlikely. So what could happen next is you could have a man-in-the-middle attack. Right? And a man-in-the-middle attack is where someone's looking inside your SSL or TLS tunnel. Okay, And they happen periodically due to weaknesses in somebody's stack or something else that's going on. To get around that, we can use Windows Hello. And Windows Hello, and it sort of combines with Microsoft now use the term Hello, which is gesture-based, which basically opens up a TPM. And inside that TPM, we have the ability to store public and private keys to give us access to resources. Okay, so our password never, ever moves across the channel at all. What we'll do is we'll get a challenge, and what we're going to do is encrypt the challenge with a private key that we've got, which never leaves our system. Right? And it will be sent back. If you're interested in the actual mechanism of that, have a look at the FIDO spec, right? Because it's part of the Fast ID online. And also, there is one vulnerability in it. The first challenge could be stolen. So what you need to do is bind it to the device as well. And Windows Hello will bind it to the device. So not only are we authenticating the user, we're authenticating the device. So if the tunnel was broken, they can't steal your password. Right? So we've effectively eliminated passwords completely. So if you want to find out more, obviously come back for part two, where I'm going to look at assigning applications to our users that we've now got. There's a five-day hands-on masterclass. If you didn't take a brochure, do take a brochure. If you want to ask me anything about it, please do so. I've also got a TechNet blog. If you have a look at a search on mastering identity and put my name in, that will pop up. And of course, always available for consulting. Unlike this evening's event, which was free, I do unfortunately charge for consulting, but I'm available for that. And what we'll do is we'll come back after the break, and then I'll start away again. But if you've got any questions, by all means ask. Thanks.